meteorological spring officially starts today. That might be hard to believe if you step outside to the cold and windy temperatures. It's been a year of extreme weather, something that hits farmers the hardest.
In 2012, we at least started with some water in the ground. I've dug some post holes this winter, and it's just dust.
That's Southern Illinois farmer Ken Schaefer. We talk weather and climate with Ken, state climatologist Jim Angel, and meteorologist Jeff Frame. Plus, 23 years ago this week, Illinois' most famous athlete made his dramatic return to basketball.
Jordan still looking for his first field goal, and there it is, Michael Jordan.
That's the voice of Marv Albert. And of course, Michael Jordan's first game back after retiring. We'll be joined by WBEZ's Chicago Cheryl Ray Stout, who broke that story back in 1995. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned, but first, the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's March 20th, which means it's time for voters across Illinois to pick Democratic and Republican candidates for elected office. Don't forget to go vote today. Even if you're not registered, Illinois does have same-day registration. Polls are open until 7 p.m. tonight. And at 7 p.m., I'll be hosting statewide coverage of those races with special hourly newscasts at the top of the hour. So tune into this public radio station for that. March 20th is also officially the first day of spring. Although that hasn't exactly happened yet. It might not feel that way just yet. I don't know about your part of the state, but the wind is pretty cold today in Champaign-Urbana. And it was a fairly cold winter, especially in northern and central Illinois. Here in Champaign, though, we did start the year with record low temperatures. And we've seen crazy extremes, not just with our temperatures. We've seen flooding and droughts. In Freeport and parts of the Illinois Valley, that flooded. In the case of Freeport, water froze overnight. On the other hand, parts of southern Illinois have seen a dry winter with not nearly enough rain, which has some farmers worried that this year will be a repeat of the 2012 when droughts stretched into late spring. So what's going on? We're going to be talking about both weather and climate today. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. That's our handle, 21st Show. Let's start, though, with someone who deals with this firsthand. Ken Schaefer is a farmer in Jersey County, just north of St. Louis. He raises cows and farms hundreds of acres of soy, corn, and winter wheat. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Ken, how's this winter gone for you?
It's probably been one of the driest winters I can ever remember. We've had the trace of snow maybe three times, nothing real measurable. I'm not complaining because it's kind of nice to go out and feed the cattle without boots on and getting stuck in the mud and everything. But on the other side, we're very concerned about the year ahead and whether the crops will get off to a good start because of the lack of moisture.
Can you explain to us non-farm folks why it's important to have that snow in the winter, what that does to the soil and how that prepares makes your work and what you're growing more successful when it comes to planting season?
Well, we like to get a lot of snow because snow melts slowly and it usually able to filter down into the ground to help the subsoil moisture out. We went into the winter season with hardly any subsoil moisture. I went out and dug a couple of post holes to put up some electric fence, and from 6 inches down to about 30 inches, it was actually just dust, which was very unusual for the fall to be that way.
And can you remind us, I wonder if this reminds you of 2012, that was a pretty tough year. Is it similar to that or not as bad yet? What do you think?
I'd say not as bad yet. I think in 2012 it was the heat that we had in August that really burned the crops a lot. They were very starved for moisture in the summertime. Usually we're not real concerned about dryness in the spring. However, you always want to know there's subsoil moisture there to keep the plants growing through that prime growing season, which is, of course, May, June, and July.
I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Madeline Beck covers ag, health, and the environment for Harvest Public Media in the Illinois newsroom. She's on the line from Galesburg. Hi, Madeline. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks.
Madeline, you spoke with Ken for your story. You introduced him to us. He's here in Illinois, but you also spoke with other farmers outside of the state. What's sort of the sense of rain and farming first from your perspective of talking to farmers in Illinois and then outside Illinois as well?
Well, for Illinois, it's starting to get a little bit better with some of the rainfall, but if you move west, it's still not. When it comes to the what I call the Four Corners region, when it comes to Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico, that area is experiencing still a lot of ingrained drought. It's much worse than it is here. But then again, in 2012, that historic drought, we actually had more moisture right now in Illinois than we did. So it really depends. Things can really change coming into summer here.
And Ken, how do you plan ahead? Is there anything you can do now, or are you just sort of hoping that maybe we have a couple more months here and hopefully we'll get a couple, for you and your part of the state, there'll be hopefully a bit more rain in the next few months?
Well, of course, we're always hoping for adequate rainfall. Just what adequate is hard to determine, but we had a good rainfall yesterday. We actually got about an inch and a half of rain, but the ground was so dry it just soaked it up so quickly, which was kind of a surprise, especially the way the winter's been.
Right. Yes.
As far as what we were doing, you know, we. There might be a possibility we'll plan to probably a little lower corn population just because we know that the moisture reserves aren't there in the soil yet. But with the cool temperatures we're going to have this week, I don't think we're going to get in a big hurry to be planting corn yet. The ground temperatures are just so cold. The evenings have been cold. They're talking actually upper 20s here in Jersey County for the next couple of evenings.
And I've got two folks in studio who were just agreeing with you there, Ken, and I want to introduce them. Jim Angel is here with me in Urbana. He's our Illinois State climatologist. Jeff Frame is with us as well. He's a meteorologist who teaches atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois. Jeff, Jim, welcome back to the 21st, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And you all
great
can
to
officially,
be back.
We have 3 minutes before spring officially begins. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah. Spring begins officially at 11:15 a.m. this morning. So happy spring, everybody, although it doesn't feel like it anywhere in the state.
Well, and to Ken's point about planting, Jeff, I just wanted to ask you, first of all, just sort of what we're seeing throughout the state. Ken's talking about sort of he's just north of St. Louis, that part of the state. Is that the driest part of the state that we've seen so far this year?
Yeah, that's really the only part of the state that's in drought. We did have more widespread drought December, January, and the first part of February were quite dry. But right around President's Day, February 19th, 20th, somewhere in there about a month ago, we had a big moisture-laden storm system come up from the south and sat over us for like 3 days. And the result was the state of Illinois, the entire state averaged, had the wettest February on record. Including the wettest February on record here in Champaign-Urbana. But unfortunately, that area where Ken is, just north of St. Louis, there's still some drought lingering there. And hopefully they'll get some needed rainfall as we head into next week.
And Jim, what about these temperatures? This is the average. It seems a little chillier than I was like, now we have a minute left of winter, technically. Right?
That's right. Yeah, enjoy it while you can. Yeah, it's a little colder than normal for this time of year. But it's pretty typical of spring and especially March, where we kind of oscillate between winter conditions one day and spring-like conditions the next day. So that's actually the more typical case. The more normal case is to actually bounce back and forth like that.
Madeline, what has the Department of Agriculture been saying about droughts nationally, about, as they're pointing out, we've also had some, and we'll get to this in a minute, we've also had flooding in certain parts of Illinois as well. Madeline, what is the Department of Agriculture saying about nationally this situation?
Well, nationally, they've been just working with a couple other organizations to keep up what's called the United States Drought Monitor. And it right now has been showing that just some of the more ingrained drought is northern Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and those four corner states. And they've been generally just encouraging farmers to get crop insurance, pretty much what they do every year, just in case, because like they've been saying and like I've said, when it comes to spring, you really just don't know whether that rain's going to be there or not.
Ken, is that something, do you think you might have to rely on crop insurance a bit more this year?
Definitely. We purchased the most coverage we could get, which is 85% level on both the corn and the soybeans this year, just as protection. But you got to remember, at 85%, you still have a 15% loss locked in, which for a lot of farms, that's the margin they have to work with.
And I wonder, Ken, if you can also explain to us a little bit more what kind of financial adjustments you also have to make if it's a really dry winter. You mentioned also just in terms of not just dry, but then with the temperatures, you might be planting less?
Well, not planting less, but a good chance that we would probably plant a little bit lower corn population just so the plants that are there can take advantage of the moisture that's available with a high population. Of course, you need a lot of moisture to keep those plants growing.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Madeline, are you hearing from other farmers about how they're sort of planning to adjust planting already? I guess this is the time of year when all of those plans are being made, right, Madeline?
Yeah, and a lot of them in other places already have been made. When it comes to, I talked with a lot of folks in southern Colorado and in southwestern Colorado, there has already been a winter wheat crop that has died. So people are already dealing with that. And a couple weeks ago, many people had made the decision of whether or not to order seeds for this upcoming summer season. Some did, some didn't. A lot of the crop down there right now is sunflowers. And so a lot of them ordered the seeds and a lot of people stopped. They just didn't know if there was going to be enough moisture this year.
Hmm. So nationally, what are we looking at, Madeline? It just seems like right now, not a very clear picture of what things are going to be going into this growing season.
Right. Yeah. No. And nationally, one really interesting thing to look at is if you do check out the U.S. Drought Monitor, you can compare it to past years. And right now, it does have some similar patterns across the United States to what it did look like in 2012. So that has its own concerns. But if you look at the very next year, 2013, that's when things started to rebound from that massive drought. And at this time that year, it was much worse. So like you said, there's a lot of uncertainty just because of the different storm systems that could crop up and just absolutely wipe out the drought and
right.
cause the opposite.
And so, Ken, for you, it sounds like there's still plenty of time for rain to turn things around for you, right?
Well, I couldn't say that precisely because we need rains all through the summer. You know, it's always helpful when you have good subsoil moisture because when you do have these extended dry periods that the roots of the crop can reach down into that. This year, a little concerned because that moisture is not there the way it was. Like Madeline said, in 2012, we did have good moisture to start the year out. Too much moisture, of course, the roots are too shallow, and if you have an extended dry period, the crops just suffer because the roots aren't down to where the moisture is.
That's Ken Schaefer. He farms in southwestern Illinois. He's just north of St. Louis, actually, in Jersey County. Ken, thanks for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Madeline, you too. I appreciate you joining us. Madeline Beck is a reporter with Harvest Public Media and also the Illinois Newsroom. Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you.
Jeffrey, can I ask you, we've got a couple of just about 2 minutes before we go to a break, but at the beginning of I mentioned three different weather events in Illinois over the past couple of months. The cold temperatures, mm-hmm. flooding, possible droughts. So maybe we could just start with how you think this winter has gone compared to years past.
Well, this winter has averaged, I believe, slightly below normal in terms of temperatures, but it feels a lot colder than that because the last two winters were so warm. We had the strong El Nino 15-16, and then last year it was even warmer than that, and that was very unexpected. So coming back to a more average type of winter temperature was a shock to the system, especially how cold it was. I think New Year's Day, most of the state didn't even get above zero for daytime highs.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I was driving, this was such a weird thing for me. I was driving south on New Year's Day from Michigan to here, and it kept getting colder the further south I went, which just was, I felt like, not how things are supposed to be.
You want to know why? Well, we had west flow coming in, northwest flow coming in from Canada. Lake Michigan was not frozen, so if you have open water there, that water is at least 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and it'll warm up the air that goes over it. Meanwhile, here in Champaign, that same northwest wind is not coming over a warm body of water. It's coming over cold land, so it was quite a bit colder here than it was in parts of Michigan.
Right. So when we coming back, we're going to sort of talk about the difference between weather and climate with Jeff Frame, who's a meteorologist. He teaches in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, and Jim Angel, who's our state climatologist. Jim, I want to hear from you also about the National Climate Assessment Survey that you're involved with. If you have questions or comments about the weather, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Stick around. We're going to pick up this conversation just after this short break. Thanks for tuning into the 21st on this first day of spring. It is officially spring now, even if it doesn't feel that way. We're talking about weather and climate with our state climatologist, Jim Angel. He's based here at the University of Illinois with the Prairie Research Institute, along with Jeff Frame, who also teaches at the University of Illinois in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. He's a meteorologist as well. You can always chime in with your questions or comments. Tweet to 21STShow. So we're talking about droughts before the break, but I wanted to ask you about the flooding. And Jim, in particular, I remember when we talked to certain towns that flooded, they were explaining to us that they had floods, they had water that sort of built on top of ice. So they had flooding over ice, and that was the problem a couple of weeks ago. Is that a common thing to happen?
That's right. If you look at a couple of weeks ago, of course, the rain was in February, which in itself is unusual. Usually we get snow instead of rain.
Right. I was like thinking also, how often have I ever heard thunder in Illinois in February?
That's
These are kind of unusual things, right?
That's right. Yeah. So I heard thunder in January and February. So every month except March so far. I haven't heard it in March. But yeah, if you look back at that big rain event, from about Champaign northward, a lot of the soils were frozen. From here southward, we're kind of the dividing line, and south of here they were unfrozen. So when the rain fell on unfrozen soil, most of it was able to soak in and do some good. But when the rain fell on frozen soils, instead of soaking in, it had no place to go, so it ran off. So we saw a lot of strong flooding from here northward just because of that particular fact, even though we actually had higher rainfall totals in some areas south of here. But a lot of the really bad flooding was north of here. So you had that problem of rain falling on frozen soils. Now, in some cases, after a day or two, some of those soils would thaw out. And so it's like pulling the plug on the bathtub. It would suddenly, the floodwaters would disappear. But in other places, it didn't. I'd say probably the northwest part of the state was probably the worst because that's probably the coldest part of the state. and they remain frozen up there. And in fact, they actually had the floodwaters freeze after the rain had fallen. So that's probably even the worst case scenario of worse than just flooding is having it freeze in place, because then you're really stuck.
And so how typical is something like that in terms of a weather event, Jim?
Yeah, that's fairly unusual. February is typically our driest month of the year. Here in Champaign, we only get about 2 inches on average. And so to get that much, we got almost 6 inches during that just about a 5-day period there. So that's very unusual for us. But we have seen that every once in a while. We had a couple of years ago, we had a big rain event right after Christmas in 2015 that caused widespread flooding, kind of pretty much the same setup as what we had here back in February. But they are less common in the winter months, but this was actually more like a springtime event. It just happened a little early.
And so I think the question that a lot of people always wonder about when we see extreme weather events, even when it's something like the nor'easter or the blizzards that have happened on the East Coast this year, tornadoes that were happening in Alabama yesterday, I think a lot of people wonder how much of this is due to climate change. So before I ask you that, I was just going to ask either of you to sort of weigh in, if you can just sort of explain the difference between weather and climate first. I feel like we should probably. Jim, do you want to answer that?
Okay. I'll take a crack at that. Yeah, that one's always an interesting discussion. Kind of my operational definition of that is the weather or meteorology really focuses on what's happening in the atmosphere right now and what's going to happen in the next couple of days and what may have happened the last couple of days. So it's a more of the short-term view. Climate and climatology, and it looks at the long view. So we might look at, 10, 20, 50, 100 years of data and look at the trends and patterns like that. So it's a lot of times we're talking about the same kind of stuff, but we just look at it from different viewpoints.
So, right. So if it would be accurate to say, Jeff, you're looking at the weather now, and Jim, you're studying climate as well over the long term.
That's right.
All right.
And in the way I like to put it to students, climate is what you expect, weather is what you get.
So what do we expect now then? Do we have good models for what we can expect?
Oh, okay. We have, as far as what we'd expect in terms of long-term climate change, we've been refining those models over time, and those are actually giving us lots of good information of how the future climate will change or may change. But there's still a lot of things we'd like to be answered that we really can't yet. So, for example, a good one, everybody wants to know have tornadoes changed over time, and are they going to change in the future as far as their frequency and intensity and so forth? That's a really tough topic because our historical data is not that great, and the ability of the models to reproduce the kind of conditions that are conducive for tornadoes in the future is not always that great either. So that's one of those, I would say, still kind of the unanswered questions moving forward.
So that's an unanswered question for tornadoes. What about for things like hurricanes or for floods like what we saw in Houston last year?
Yeah, well, I'd say probably my highest confidence is in things really to temperature. The models have been very good and very consistent about identifying temperature trends and how they're going to play out. And we've been working with climate models for over 30 years. So now we kind of know what their performance is like, because when you look at the historical data for over that time period too. So high confidence in temperature kind of related activities. And I'd say kind of medium confidence on the precipitation type of things. There's a lot of more uncertainty in that. When you get to things like hurricanes, there's a lot of competing factors going on. In fact, I think you probably talk to the meteorologists and climatologists, they come up a different list of what the things that they're looking at, which is kind of unfortunate. So I think in the past there was maybe overconfidence that we thought we'd see a lot more hurricanes, and now I think they've kind of modified that a little bit or qualified that a little bit. And we are seeing more storms in the Pacific, strangely enough, but in the Atlantic hurricane seasons have been unusually quiet up until this year.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Right. So picking up on the hurricanes, for example, one thing that we think is going to happen is that the most intense storms could get maybe 10% more intense by the end of the century due to climate change. But like Jim said, the unknown factor is number of storms. Will we see more storms or fewer storms or no change? And right now, we just can't say a whole lot about that. And the stronger storms would be due to just the warmer ocean temperatures.
And that's due, again, to Jim, to your point, that we are getting warmer. And so that we're very confident of, that we're getting warmer. And that's a trend that you're pretty confident about will continue, it sounds
yes.
like.
Yes. Highly confident.
Highly confident. Yeah. The world is getting warmer. And then, so Jim, as you do this, I know you're part of the National Climate Assessment Survey. You're the lead Midwest author for the federal government for that. How is the government studying this? How are you? What are you working on in those regards?
Yeah, so the latest National Climate Assessment is underway as we speak. It's about a 2-year process, and believe it or not, it was actually started by President Bush back several years ago.
Which President
Bush? As soon as I said that, I was trying to think. I think it's actually the senior.
Okay.
So the first President Bush, and it was a bipartisan push because they wanted to report on how climate change is affecting the United States. So they wanted to know all the details about what's really happening out there, and so this has been a bipartisan push, and they get a team of scientists, and a lot of the team is actually made up from the academic community. And then there's also some federal folks involved with it as well. So it's kind of a mix of inside and outside authors in this. And the idea is that we're going through and every 4 years looking at what's new on climate change. So, for example, in the Midwest, obviously we look at a lot of impacts of climate change on agriculture. And not only the future changes, but what we're seeing so far. So we're seeing things like heavier rains across the board and wetter springs. And so really, I mean, we talked earlier about drought today, but probably in the last 10 years, I'd say probably 8 of those 10 years, we've had bigger headaches in the springtime with it being too wet, which has delayed planting, caused a lot of replanting and other issues. And so those are the kind of things that we're concerned about moving forward is how this is going to impact agriculture.
And how many people are working on this, Jim, across the country?
I think there's probably about 300 scientists that are working on this. So we got different parts of the country, and then we got different economic sectors as well. So it's a big report, and we're right in the middle of the process. So we'll probably have it out in final form. The target is November of this year.
And has the Trump administration, has there been any change in the Trump administration on your work in terms of this climate report? As someone who's working on this at this level, you said there's 300 people kind of across the country. Does what's happening in Washington affect your work?
You know, surprisingly, knock on wood, it hasn't had a big effect on us yet. They've still, the federal agencies still are participating, and we still get some money on the federal side to support meetings and things like that. So far it's still been moving along. I'd say the one thing that's different this time from the last assessment 4 years ago is there's not as much participation by the White House. 4 years ago we had President Obama in the White House, and he was very much interested in this report. And so I think even they had a press release at the White House for that. So I suspect this time it will be downplayed.
Our phone number, we've got a couple more minutes if you want to talk to Jeff and Jim as we're talking about weather and climate, is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Rob's on the line from Urbana. Hey, Rob, welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Hey, Jeff and Jim, I just wanted to know if you've read, had a chance to look at a book that's come out recently. It's called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change by... The author's name is Mark Morano, and it's gotten some press in recent days, really, as the book is advertised as a point-by-point takedown of the predictions of disasters made by climate change, and it's, suffice it to say, written pretty much from that.
So, Rob, is it written from the perspective that climate change is not happening? Is that
yes? Yes. I just wondered if either of these folks have had a chance to look at that book and just maybe what their thoughts are.
Yeah. What's your response, guys? I'm sure you get a lot of questions from different people who say to you that how do we really know climate change is happening? Mm-hmm. As Rob is talking about this book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change. I haven't heard of it, Rob. Thanks for bringing it to our attention. I'm sure there's lots of things out there that are sort of, I guess I would say, trying to debunk the work that you were doing as a scientist, right? Because I imagine you would disagree with that perspective. But I wonder how you respond to people, whether they say there's uncertainty about the climate, or whether or not climate change is happening. Jim, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that book, because I just had heard about that today. I was looking at something else and somebody mentioned that. I would say in general that, and this is probably true of a lot of people that work in this field, if you work in it long enough, you probably have heard every theory and everybody's opinion on climate change. And so I'm sure whatever's in this book, I probably have already seen or heard before. So, yeah, we do a lot of time, spend a lot of time addressing those kind of things. And a lot of it's misconceptions about data or the actual climate process that's at work. And I would say also that kind of stepping back a little bit is that there's a study out by Yale University where they call it the Six Americas on Climate Change. And we kind of think of climate change opinions as being binary, yes or no, I believe it or I don't believe it. But there's actually a full range of views from I don't believe it at all to I'm very concerned about it. And about 75% of the people have at least some concern about climate change. The other funny thing is I talked to a lot of farmers who are, you know, by and large, are a fairly conservative group, both in terms of their money and also their viewpoints. And, you know, when it comes to affecting the bottom line, then, you know, ideas of the ideology kind of goes by the wayside. And so we end up having a lot of conversations about climate change, or they talk about, you know, weather trends on their farm and so forth. So it is a different kind of conversation than what you see on the news shows.
Yeah, Jeff, what do you say to people who maybe they think, I don't know if they are looking at the temperatures and saying maybe the planet is getting warmer, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's happening because of climate change.
Right. Well, if you look at the data over the past 130 years, the global average temperature has gone up by about 1 degree Celsius, or that's 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, with climate change, it's very hard, unless you're a farmer, to see it by looking out the window, because what you see looking out the window are the day-to-day weather events. So I think a good analogy of that is, for example, this winter was colder than last winter. That doesn't disprove climate change or global warming. For example, just like today is colder, at least here in Champaign and up in Chicago as well, it's colder than it was yesterday. That doesn't disprove that summer is coming. So as you go from winter into summer, some days are colder than previous ones because of day-to-day weather variability. And as you go over a period of years, some years can be colder than previous ones because of natural climate oscillations like La Nina in the Pacific Ocean, for example. But adding CO2 to the atmosphere, all things being equal, results in a warmer planet.
And that's what the data shows for the past, as you're saying, 130 years? Is that as long as the records that you guys are looking at have been
thermometers.
Thermometers.
Yeah.
So that's for you all the accurate sort of apples to apples comparison is 130 years worth of data.
That's right. And, you know, one of the responses we hear a lot is that, well, there's always been climate change, you know, the glaciers and so forth. And that's true. There's a lot of natural climate change, but this is the first one we've tracked that's actually we're contributing to the climate change. And it's happening in more rapid rate than we've seen in other times in history. We can reconstruct things farther back with indirect evidence, looking at tree pollen and things like that. But this is the one that's we're here, so this is an important one for us. It doesn't matter if it was, you know, 200,000 years ago it was warmer, but it's what's happening right now.
That's our state climatologist, Jim Angel. He's at the Prairie Research Institute. I want to thank him along with Jeff Frame, who is in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. Both of you, thanks so much for being here with me on this first day of spring. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Yeah, thank you.
The The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Studies MillerCom 18 Lecture Series, presenting Toward a Manifesto for Diverse Psychological Science, March 26th to 4 p.m. at Beckman Institute. Professor of Psychology Enrique Neblett will discuss incorporating diversity and the human experience into psychological science. cas.illinois.edu.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. We've been told to eat our fruits and veggies starting from when we were kids. And, you know, it turns out you probably should keep that up well into middle age and beyond. We already know that leafy greens in particular are good for your health. But a recent study by Rush University found that it could also boost your memory. Our researchers at Rush found that eating either one or three cups of lettuce a day or about half a cup of cooked dark greens helps keep your brain sharp. In fact, out of the people studied, those who were between the ages of 58 to 99 who ate leafy greens had brains that were functioning as well as people up to 11 years younger. I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Martha Claire Morris. She's a nutritional epidemiologist. She is at Rush in Chicago to tell us more about this. Dr. Morris, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
First, can you explain what a nutritional epidemiologist is?
Well, if you think of the word epidemic, that's the word of epidemiologist. So we study diseases, but we do so in large populations. And I concentrate on studies that look at nutrition in relation to diseases.
Ah, okay. So if we were doing a media headline of this, it would scream something like, eat kale and it will make your brain a decade younger. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I guess that could be a summary way of saying it. Among the green leafy vegetables would be kale, collards, and other greens, spinach, romaine lettuce. Those are all those darker green leafy vegetables are the ones that are richest in the nutrients that we looked at, that many of them have been shown to be really important for the brain. And then others of those nutrients are perhaps new nutrients that we will discover are so important for the brain.
And why are they so important for the brain?
When you have each nutrient has its own role in the brain. So vitamin E is one of the nutrients that we looked at that is included in green leafy vegetables. And that has a very broad literature in animal and human studies showing that it decreases amyloid in the brain, which is one of the hallmark characteristics of Alzheimer's disease. Vitamin E has also been shown to reduce the loss of neurons with aging. It's a very potent antioxidant as well as an anti-inflammatory.
Okay. And when we say leafy greens, what falls into this category of having these, both the antioxidants and the vitamins you're talking about?
So what would those nutrients be?
No,
I'm asking,
so we're thinking on lettuce, kale, what other kinds of leafy greens? What falls into that category?
Spinach, kale, collards, greens, romaine lettuce, arugula, even iceberg lettuce would fall into that category. However, the darker the leafy green, the more potent it is in nutrients.
Okay. So that's interesting because I think people always tend to think iceberg lettuce doesn't have as much nutrients as, say, kale, and it sounds like you're saying they have some, but it's not as potent.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so the study was called the Rush Memory and Aging Project, and you tracked 960 people from the ages of 58 to 99 over the course of 5 years. And so when we think about aging being a natural part of life, I guess it also involves being more vulnerable to disease. What exactly are leafy greens? So we talked about the nutrients. What kinds of things do you leafy greens help protect against apart from all of this in terms of the brain?
You mean what other health conditions other than cognitive changes and dementia?
Did you all look? You all look just at the cognitive changes in dementia,
right?
Okay.
Yes. Actually, I'm not aware that there's been a lot of study looking at leafy greens in particular in relation to other diseases. People have looked at vegetable consumption, but I really don't think that there's been a focus of very many studies on types of vegetables and how they might be important. We have looked at Alzheimer's disease, and we've looked at cognitive change with aging, and we found that the leafy greens were important for reducing those brain-related conditions.
Are there other, and I know this is the one study that you all have done, so I imagine there's still a lot of work to be done, but are there other foods you also recommend that people eat on a regular basis? Are there other foods you're interested in studying that may also help improve cognitive function?
Oh, yeah. So seafood is one. Our group has done quite a bit of study showing that seafood consumption of just one meal per week can reduce your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by 60%. And what's interesting is that most studies, including ours, don't find that even more seafood meals per week gives you even greater benefit. However, I think that unless you're in a very high fish eating community, or you have a study that has very high fish consumption, it would be difficult to answer that question. But for most people, just eating one seafood meal a week can reduce your risk.
All right, seafood, and of course, this study had to do with leafy greens. We'll tweet out more information if you'd like to read more about it. I'd like to thank Dr. Martha Claire Morris. She's a professor and director with the Section of Nutrition and Nutritional Epidemiology at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Morris.
Thank you. Take care.
Jordan still looking for his first field goal. And there it is. Michael Jordan.
Remember that voice? It's NBC's Marv Albert describing the return of, that's right, Michael Jordan. 23 years ago this week, Illinois' most famous number 23 decided to come back to basketball, though at the time, he did come back as number 45. On March 18th, 1995, Michael Jordan declared he was coming back to play for the Chicago Bulls. He had originally retired 2 years before that. He played minor league baseball for a while, and he made his announcement, this sounds very 1995, with a fax message that said two words, "I'm back." In the run-up to that announcement, a reporter named Cheryl Ray was following the story and was the first to break the news for radio station WMVP. Cheryl Ray Stout is now a WBEZ sports contributor, and she's on the line with us. Hey, Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So, Cheryl, as we think about this, 1995 just seems like a totally different world in so many ways, but in sports, can you first describe what the sports media landscape was like at the time, especially in professional basketball?
Well, you had media coverage, but you also had, it was mainstream media. You didn't have bloggers, you didn't have access people, but you did have what happened with during the Jordan era, particularly. You had international media that was covering. You had people from all over the country covering the Bulls. So there was a lot of people, but it was all mainstream media. You didn't have the internet. You didn't have Twitter. You didn't have Instagram. So you had to work your stories. You had to work your sources, and you also had more access to players and coaches and staff than you do now.
Right, because you used to just, you were on the plane with them. You would be on the plane.
I was not on the plane with them. No. That was the thing. We divided ourselves away from the team. Sometimes, though, the station would actually put me in the same hotel, which I asked them, please don't ever do that again, because the fans that would be in the lobby, they would come to your room and knock on your door because they thought you were one of the players or part of the team. So I said, no, no, thank you.
That's kind of crazy. So I wonder if you can take us back to March of 1995. You're reporting for WMVP. Do you remember when you first got an inkling that Michael Jordan might come back?
Exactly, I do. And it was actually March 10th. I was at a practice at the Berto. Now, they have an electronic curtain that they would pull down and up. Now, behind that, you could hear the sound. What happened was there was no TV cameras covering the Bulls anymore because, remember, Michael wasn't there. There was only five of us reporters, and I was the only one that had been covering the Bulls for several years beforehand. And so I knew the sound of the practice was different. It was the Michael Jordan practice. It was loud. It was very different than it had been. So I knew he could possibly be there. Then I got a phone call from somebody I knew that was at spring training that Michael had left the White Sox training camp. There was a dispute going on because the strike was going on with baseball. And so he had walked out of camp. Then, and back then, you didn't have cell phones like you have now. You had some, but they didn't work the greatest. We used beepers. And I was able to connect with a friend of a player. And he told me that Michael was there, and that he was, you know, practicing with the team. So I put that all together, didn't tell anybody else that was around me. When we walked into the practice area after they opened up the curtain, we were allowed to go there. I did ask Phil Jackson when there was no one around, and he says, you know, he wasn't going to answer me directly, but he did say he was there. And B.J. Armstrong told me he was there, but they couldn't answer anymore. So I had the story. He was there. There's no doubt about it. I call up the station. I'm live on the air. And while I'm talking on the air, my beeper goes off. And I just toss the beeper aside. So, you know, I can't, you know, I got to, you know, be concentrating on going on the air. I do the story about Michael. And I go retrieve my beeper and I look at it. And it's the friend of the player. And I call him up. He goes, Cheryl, I had Michael here waiting for you to talk to you.
And what did he say, Cheryl?
Well, I didn't know. Michael had left.
Oh, okay.
But he was confirming that what Michael had said, he was coming back.
And can you take us back to what it was like in Chicago and the whole state when that announcement happened?
Now, remember, I first started the story on the 10th. And so we had days and days where we were waiting, you know, for practices and stuff like that and trying to get the message. And we were at a practice when that email came out. That was a press release. It was a fax. It was an email. I'm sorry. It was a fax from David Falk. That was Michael Jordan's agent from Washington. Now, the whole paragraph was, you know, all about his sports agency. And then the words, I'm back, was there. And you can't imagine how many people were there. People would be in the driveway, you know, trying to get pictures, trying to get sound. Will Perdue actually gave me a poem to read on the air. I mean, it was insane. And then when he did come back on the 19th, the next day after that email, in Indianapolis, I was down there at Market Square Arena. It was filled with media. It was, you know, and even the Pacer fans were kind of enjoying the fact that Michael was coming down there. The crowd outside the arena was like a concert, like a rock concert. There were things being sold, and there was placards being given out, and it was just a really exciting time. Now, he didn't have a great night. I mean, he only shot 7 of 28 and had 18 points, and he wore number 45 because that was his baseball number still. But the feeling about Michael returning to the NBA, it was really huge for everybody. The whole league really embraced him, and so did the fans.
All right, so we could say this moment in Illinois history has been brought to you by WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Raystout. Cheryl, I'm sure there are parents who are listening who have to explain what a beeper and a fax is to their children, so we will just leave it at that. But I appreciate you sharing the story and us remembering. We had to have a conversation about this because it was 23 years ago this week that Michael Jordan came back to the Chicago Bulls. Thanks for being with me, Cheryl.
You're welcome, Nyla.
A reminder, today, of course, is primary day. So if you want to still help choose the Democratic or Republican candidates for the November election, there's still time. Polls close at 7 p.m. If you haven't registered to vote, you can still do so at your local polling place today. Just make sure you bring two forms of ID. One of them has to have your current address on it. It can even be a utility bill or a bank statement. And if you're not 18 yet, but you will be by November 6th, you can also vote in today's primary. Finally, if you have any other questions or run into problems with voting, the nonpartisan Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights has set up a hotline. That number is 866-OUR-VOTE. That's 866-OURVOTE. As the results come in this evening, we'll be broadcasting special election night updates from your station. So stay tuned to this public radio station. We'll get that started right at 7 o'clock when the polls close. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, Grace Stetson, and Fatima Farha are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks for tuning in today, and don't forget to go out and vote. Have a good day.